Hello, my sweet little panda bear cuties, and thank you for joining us at the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. Actually, panda bears aren't that cute. They're dirty creatures. I saw a YouTube video of a panda bear pissing in another panda bear's mouth. They're not cute. They're hot. Anyway, my stuffy old attorney has informed me that I must tell you that at this very moment, subneural, binaural, some kind of sound wave crap they're making me put into the podcast at the beginning is being blasted into The Duncan Trussell Family Hour is partially sponsored by a coven of necromancers that currently call themselves Sure Design T-Shirts. Sure Design T-Shirts is a t-shirt company located in Thailand. These folks are so committed to their job that every day they rub the ashes of their ancestors on their bodies so that they can channel the spirits of the dead, which direct them in their activities in the incredible Sure Design T-Shirt factory, which I hope to visit one day. Here's an interesting little bit of trivia about Sure Design T-Shirts. Sure Design T-Shirts is the company that the Bohemian Grove uses to create their sacrificial robes. When you're sacrificing an Iraqi or Afghani baby and driving your black and poison dagger deep into their heart to extract the fear fluid that you then rub on Dick Cheney's balls to keep him alive because he has no skeletal system, he does not have a heart, and he doesn't have a brain. He's just filled with a black pulpy mash that falls out of truckers' mouths when they expire from methamphetamine overdoses, and to keep him going, you gotta rub that shit on his balls and his taint, or otherwise he will explode, and the explosion will create a black hole that will suck all of us into the mouth of the great rooster god Abraxas. And you just can't make sacrifices like that when you're in an uncomfortable robe. So go to SureDesignT-Shirts.com, order one of their beautiful shirts, put my name in, you get 10% off. We're also sponsored by Audible.com. Audible is my number one ally in the war I'm waging against the asymmetrical love handles that currently are bloating out of the middle of my waist, like the glands of some awful Lovecraftian swamp toad. It keeps me on the treadmill. Nothing has kept me on the treadmill more than a wonderful Audible audiobook, and I've tried everything except heroin. Nothing keeps you glued to the treadmill more than these audiobooks because the narrators are incredible. And if you get a good book, like the Dark Tower series, which I'm listening to right now, you don't want to get off. You want to keep running till you get to the end of the chapter. It's also great if you have some other boring stuff that you have to do every day, like walk your dog or do the dishes or dissolve the bodies of your victims in hydrochloric acid or whatever the thing is that you need some distraction from. Audible is the perfect thing for that. So go to audibletrial.com/familyhour and you will get a free audiobook if you sign up for a trial membership. You get to download one free audiobook, and those things normally cost $25-$30. Also, they send me $15. So do it. Go to audibletrial.com and sign up for that. And then after you sign up for that, make your last stop at DuncanTrussell.com. Not only do we have a shop there filled with some of the most incredible merchandise that's ever existed, t-shirts designed by the Warlocks at Sure Design T-Shirts, amazing posters, and new posters are coming soon, we also have one of the greatest forums of all time filled with super smart people and incredible ongoing threads that can help you stop smoking, that can teach you to garden, that can help you stop jerking off to porn, and a variety of other incredible things, including a Minecraft server. And also, they meet up in different cities across the country, and that's pretty cool. So go to DuncanTrussell.com, join the forum, check out the shop. And as always, to those of you who have donated, to the podcast. God bless you. Hare Krishna. Holy shit. Thank you for keeping this thing going. Thanks for supporting the Duncan Trussell Family Hour. My eternal gratitude to you. And may your children grow up to be strong and beautiful beings that escape from the simulator we know as reality. And ask the programmer why he only made orgasms last for 30 seconds at the most. Now I am incredibly excited to welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour the creator of the hit NBC show Community and the showrunner of that show and the executive producer of that show until the bastards unceremoniously gave him the boot. You can read about that drama at his hilarious blog, danharmon.tumblr.com. It's pretty intense. They didn't even call him. He worked on the show for 3 seasons, but he's doing fine because he's a brilliant, hilarious, philosophical, awesome human being, and it was a real pleasure chatting with him today. So everyone send out your psychic tendrils to wrap around, embrace, and invigorate the soul of this fine and wonderful human, Dan Harmon. Hi. So I wanted to talk to you. I read your and I'm not, I don't want to just start on this. It's dumb to start. We actually just, for those of you listening, we were just talking about
hard dick
sucking jizz out of our baby's eggs.
It was cooler than it sounds.
That sounds pretty, I mean, it's it is the source of all life. You wrote the most amazing fucking blog. And I it like made me so happy to read it, not just because it's really well written and really funny, but it's so, not to sound like a total weirdo, but it's so brave to create this, to respond publicly in such a smart way at what is, to me, one of the worst slaps in the face I've ever read about in my fucking life, which is that these cocksuckers didn't even call you?
No, they didn't. They didn't want to, and I'm glad they didn't. I wouldn't want to talk to them. It would have been an awkward conversation. It's funny because my girlfriend calls me a lot on the fact that I am pretty good at playing up the martyr shtick, but because I have that luxury, because they are the idiots that fired me, like, which is probably one of the dumbest things you could do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was one of the greatest strokes of luck for me. And the truth is, and with all apologies to the fans for whom I would have worked forever, it was an exhausting job.
And I
would have continued to do it only out of obligation to these people that watched the show. It wouldn't have been in pursuit of my own self-satisfaction anymore.
Right.
It would have been, it was like being in the army at a certain point. It was like, I'm doing this for my country.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it because I choose to put on camouflage and like be here. I would like to be playing video games right about
yes.
now.
Yes. And for those of you who don't know, he was a showrunner on Community, and showrunner is, I can't think of a more grueling, horrific job. Any showrunner that I've ever seen, I've always wondered, why would you do this to yourself? Because you have to work insane hours, like wretched hours, to on the shoots, and then after the shoots you have to sit in on the edits, and then you have to sit in on all the, you have to be in you're basically involved in every single aspect of the show, and it's brutal.
Yeah, well, boohoo for us, but
no, I know the whole thing. Oh yeah, listen to Mr. By the way, you're not the one saying it, I'm the one saying it. I'm not a showrunner. It's like, listen to the old poor Hollywood fancy pants. There's people working in coal mines right now, coughing their lungs out where their kids get run over by tractors. But no, man, the thing is, it really is a hard job. I mean, it's not like you're lifting heavy shit, but you're under the incredible pressure of having to produce at the level of network television. And if things go great, then that's good. But if things go bad, it's all on you. And that's fucked up, man. Pressure cooker.
Well, the bummer for me was socially having everybody above me and everybody below me kind of, having that that idea that I was that if things were going well, then no comment.
Yes.
And things were rarely going well. But if things are going poorly, then it's like, yeah, God, you know, who's this guy? It's like, what has he done? I wouldn't do a single thing different because I spent 3 years doing that job. I didn't want to spend at the end of it 3 more years doing it. As I said, I would have,
yeah.
If I was called upon to do it.
Sure.
But I didn't want to. But at the same time, I would never. That 3 years, I could have spent that 3 years sitting at the bar,
yeah,
drinking and being funny and with my friends and listening to Johnny Cash music. The reward is like so much more intense and permanent. Maybe not permanent, but for me permanent, and that I will go to my grave, the last thing that I can think about, if I do nothing else for the rest of my life, I did that show for 3 years,
right.
and that cannot be taken away from me. There will be a little stack of DVDs or holograms or something next to my deathbed that represent the fact that I did this thing,
yep.
and it cannot be undone. It was done. So nothing's more satisfying than that. There's a lot of hard jobs where you lift boxes, wash dishes, and there is no point to it. There
right.
is no permanence to it. You washed the dish, someone makes it dirty again.
Yeah.
You lifted the box. What was in the box? You don't even know. No one knows you lifted it.
Right.
They you only did it because the forklift was broken.
Yeah.
I did this show and I did it because I was the only one that could do it. And when I was done, I had accomplished something that only I could have done, and I have it for the rest of my life. And if it took 10 years off of my life biologically, it was definitely a good investment.
Do you feel like, I know you're kind of joking about that, but you think maybe it chipped some years off your life?
I think so, stress? Yeah. Well, I'll tell you in all candor, I mean, as you referred to, like, there's three balls you juggle in as a showrunner. You're in the writer's room, and then you're on set, and then you're in the edit bay.
Yeah.
Eventually, I learned that I didn't need to go to the set anymore because the actors were brilliant. We'd cast the show well. The directors we were hiring knew what they were doing. So, and that was the middle of the jump rope, and the ends were more important. So I stopped going to the set a lot.
Right.
But if they're not screwing up in the writer's room, they're screwing up in the edit bay. If you're in the writer's room making sure that you're, and I don't mean screwing up, that was a horrible choice of words. I just mean if things aren't to your liking in the writer's room, if you turn your back while you're in the edit bay, something's going on in the writer's room that's going to need to be undone.
Right.
And the exact same thing is the case in the edit bay. They're going to be spinning their wheels and doing things that you wouldn't, you need to be over there. And the truth is, biologically, there's things you do to keep yourself running on that clock. And I'm talking about, like, I took some Adderall here and there.
Oh,
and
sweet Adderall.
5-hour energy and, wash it down with vodka. And like, I do think some years come off your life living on that clock, because the writers were staying up till 4 a.m. and, like, I think everybody got a couple extra gray hairs that they wouldn't have gotten if they were working on Suddenly Susan or something.
Well, and then there's another element to it, which is that you can't be a nice guy in that job. You can't, you either get to be in a situation where everyone's like, man, that he's fucking cool, man. That's a cool guy. And then if you do that too much, then your vision of what the thing's supposed to be degenerates or turns into something different than what you want it to be. Maybe something as good, but something different. So then you end up having to be a bit of a, I don't know what the right word for it is, but from time to time, you probably have to be a cunt to get things going the way you want them to be.
Yeah, you certainly, I mean, there's times when you definitely, I can recall when I was probably a dick to people. There's a culture that develops that because the people that you're being a dick to, they kind of, like, there's a hierarchy and there's it's very much like the military. So people start saluting you and you kind of fall into it. It's like the Stanford prison experiment. Like, you fall into the behavior of a guy who has better things to do than be having this conversation. So I'm going to be very direct and say this thing. But in my defense, I don't think I didn't do that as much as the larger problem, which is just that I focused on the script so much that I held up a lot of people's precious lives. You know, the prop master's job is to get a script on Tuesday, and if they see that there's a ray gun in the script, they want to have that ray gun done on Wednesday night, and then they don't want to have a new script come out that says fuck the ray gun, or the ray gun's different, it's an octopus now. They'll do it. They'll roll with those punches. But over three seasons, they're like, God damn it, who is this fucking guy? Yeah. What's he doing? And the answer is, I don't know what I'm doing sometimes. It is a templated show, a formulaic show that's that easy to where the script comes out on Tuesday and it doesn't change from what you end up shooting. I'm pretty confident saying those are shittier shows.
Right.
They're very much more producible, but they are shittier. Like you do not get tattoos of them. You do not go to conventions dressed as them.
Right.
You watch them and they're fine and they exist, and a lot of them make a lot of money, and I think that's the big issue here. That's what we're really talking about. And I find myself, ironically, in these days now, in the afterglow of this mess, I find myself defending the people that fired me to people who don't quite understand that from their perspective, it's just who cares about the tattoo? Who cares about the costume at the convention? It didn't make them any money that someone dressed up as someone for Halloween. They didn't care. They didn't know about it. They can't care about that stuff. They'll get fired if they care about that stuff. They are looking for, they'll never admit it because it's bad PR to use this language. They are looking for the easily produced kind of popcorn that hits the spot well enough that it's on the air forever and generates a bunch of revenue. The truth is that the things that get you critical acclaim and fan adoration, I'm hoping they're not a direct obstacle to that. I hope that there's a way to be the Bob Zemeckis, the Steve Spielberg of television, where you can satisfy stupid parts of your brain and smart parts of your brain at the same time. But it certainly isn't a good sign to companies like Sony when the show has become so nuanced and niche that it's really deeply satisfying one woman at one address and everyone else on the block has never heard of the fucking show.
What a fucking conundrum, man. It really is. We're not going to be able to solve that code until we're right on the precipice of the singularity and computers are sending out nano swarms to like scan people's brains and find out exactly what the balance is between palatable and easily digested comedy in what really has heart and spirit. But
I think maybe the singularity will solve that problem, because what's going to happen is guys like me are going to keep codifying story structure, and this format's going to get so deconstructed and reconstructed that we'll never program a computer to write Citizen Kane, but we will be able to program a computer to write an episode of, I don't want to say the name of any show that my friends produce.
This brings me to the point I really wanted to talk about, because I saw on your blog also that you mentioned being a kid and having a Commodore 64, which I also had growing up as a kid. Did you ever play Archon?
Wasn't that like a chess game?
Yeah. Remember the best soundtrack. But anyway, that made me think, oh, cool. And I know you're, I also read that you play video games. You're a gamer. You like playing games. So this is the thing. I raved about, this is all I've been raving about since I found out about it. I've been walking through my house muttering, because did you hear about this guy at the University of Maryland? He's a physicist. No. So this guy basically, and I don't understand anything about supersymmetry or string theory, which is what he's into. I don't understand too much about it, but this is a respected physicist who has been trying to come up with equations to articulate the idea that we live in a supersymmetrical universe and to try to embody superstring theory. And these equations that they've come up with, the thing that the guys found that is incredibly shocking, mind-numbing, consciousness-melting, is that at the base of these equations, there appears to be computer code, strings of ones and zeros that aren't random, that actually seem to be computer code that was invented by a guy in the 1940s. The implication of this being that in
I don't quite understand that statement. At the heart of the universe, there's computer code that appears to be written by a guy in the 40s.
Yeah, in the
it's like a Dennis Quaid movie.
It is exactly like that Dennis Quaid movie, and I fucking love that movie. What was that called? Dreamscape? Was that what it was called?
Oh, I was thinking of the one where he's got a ham radio kit and he ends up talking to his dad who's dead.
No, I know what you're thinking of. Yeah, no, I was thinking of the one they put the disc on. I don't even know if that was Dennis Quaid. They put the thing and they record their
brainstorm.
Anyway, yeah, man. So the implication is in the very fabric of the universe, there appears to be computer code, and it's not just random ones and zeros. There's a name for it. It's called dual error processing code, which is something that's inside when you send an email, there's all this hidden code that somehow like translates that to different machines. And that appears to be at the base of these super symmetrical equations that the guys found. Now, here's that's one piece of the puzzle. The other piece of the puzzle is the obvious fact that we're getting really good at simulating reality, video games being one of the primary examples of that. I mean, some of the fucking particle physics in video games these days is just stunning, and it keeps getting better and better and better. So the idea is, well, yeah, obviously, if we don't blow ourselves up, then technologically in the next however many years, we're going to figure out a way to map the neural structure of a human brain and simulate that within one of these games. Or it's not going to be a game at that point. It's going to be a habit trail for disembodied sparks of consciousness that think they're real, right? So the idea is, if that's a possibility that could happen with us, and it's a very real possibility, then it probably already happened. Yeah. And we're in it.
Yeah.
So well, what I'm saying is...
And if it probably happened, then it did happen.
Yeah.
Because it's an infinite universe.
Yes.
And time doesn't exist, you know, except within the confines of one universe. And if the Big Bang becomes a big suction, you know, and the universe just throbs like a heartbeat that, then what you have is an infinite simulation of universes. I guess the question is there something outside of that?
Well, no, that's the original programmer. And so then suddenly that's where you get into this thing. Like, I never understood the whole Jesus died on the cross for our sins. I never really understood that. It never made sense to me. I could never figure out what's the magic behind that. How does it work? But of course, that's just an archetype. That's the archetype for the humans eating the God. That's in a lot of different religions. So suddenly you have this thing where it's like, no, the person who died was God. The original programmer was mortal. That was a mortal being that figured out how to make the simulator.
Oh,
and
God.
That poor son of a bitch died so that we could be infinite inside this fucking thing.
Because God so loved us that he gave his only begotten son.
Yeah.
He loved the video game so much.
Yeah.
He went into it and found out that the way for the game to last forever is to sacrifice himself as a player.
He had to die because he was mortal. He wasn't a simulation. Whoever started the fucking, the echo of the simulation, whoever started the simulation, creating the simulation inside the simulations, that was immortal. That was mortal. God, the paradox of God is God was mortal. The programmer died a long time ago. He's long gone, but the echo of his creation goes on infinitely, folding in on itself perpetually. And this is weird because it kind of is an explanation of why, you know, people say, how come we haven't seen aliens, or how come aliens don't come here. The idea is, well, maybe when a technology gets sufficiently advanced, it doesn't go out, it goes in.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's,
yeah, it makes more sense. Certainly, yeah. I mean, from our experience on this planet, we accomplish magical things with that are internal, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's hard to fucking launch a spaceship to Mars. It's going to take forever.
Sure.
So it's like hauling a goddamn boulder, and it's a pointless activity.
Why?
Because we always compare it to the ocean. It's like, that's a different situation. We always go, well, when we were kids on the planet, we had this thing called the ocean, and that was like outer space, and thank God we built ships and discovered America and figured out that dragons don't eat you if you go too far. But it's really not that analogous, because space is not a fucking ocean. It is space. It is
Fuck,
a bunch of emptiness, and you could go a long time, in fact, forever, before you find anything like the little sweet spot you got. Now, not that there's nothing else out there. It's just so far away that it's functionally non-existent. And so it makes sense that sentient beings on any of these little spots where life happens to grow, which is a very rare thing that only happens, you know, per square light year, you know, the footage is when it happens, that those people, way before they make a Mack truck that can go so much faster than the speed of light that it's able to get anywhere else where anything else is happening, way before that happens, someone's going to, as you say, develop a computer that emulates the human brain. And when that happens, you're able to put on a Wonder Woman a circlet on your head that simulates you having a vagina and a pig fucking you and
the dream.
Your mouth becoming an octopus or whatever, you know, like everything we ever dreamed of. Yeah. Like, what's out there? Nothing. In our wildest dreams, some alien that puts that thing on our head and gives us a pig vagina.
So, yeah, this is what it's like. Try to convince a group of people to go through the vacuum of space to check out a fucking desert. Like, pre-Las Vegas, just shit. You can't breathe there. It's nothing. Try to convince those people to do that when there's the technology to enter into some kind of superior hologram and live forever. And like you said, fuck everything, everything. You could know what it's like to fuck every single thing if that's what you felt like. And that is going to be, you know, on our way to this thing that apparently has already happened, but on our way to creating our own simulation within the simulation, there's something that's we're on the precipice of that people aren't talking about. And I think it's fascinating, which is sex androids and how that, you know, they say that's the future of prostitution, is that whorehouses are going to be no longer populated with real human beings, but like super advanced sex androids that are going to put prostitutes out of work. But that's something I
think prostitutes are already out of work.
The economy.
No, I was just saying, like, they, women become prostitutes in flawed societies, because you shouldn't in situations where women are allowed to do whatever they're good at, they don't tend to become prostitutes. They find out that they're, you know, they have a skill or a you know, an acumen and something. It's like selling your body is something that very few women would do. They're basically like it's a last resort kind of thing.
Here's a curious thing, man. I'm more on the same page with you, but like logically, when I think about it, like logically, I think, well, why is it bad to sell fucking? Like,
oh no, it's not. I don't think it's bad. I'm not saying.
But why would that be a flawed society?
I just think it's a sign. Like when women, more women, I think. I this is absolute speculation. I'm not based on any research or knowledge of anything. My belief is that if you went, and if we gathered 100 prostitutes, and we brought them into this room, and we were able to sort of polygraph them so that there was no like lying or anything, we could just sort of read their thoughts and feelings, I think we would find that let's say 85 of them out of the 100 would rather be doctors.
Yeah.
Would rather be airline pilots, would rather be carpenters, anything almost other than what they're doing.
Right.
I think they you would find that 85 out of the 100 of them had fallen on hard times and were resorting to a thing that they didn't want to do. I don't think there's anything. I think but 15 of them might be like, you know what? I'm a fucking nymphomaniac, man. I'm good at fucking, and I love money, and I it's hard washing dishes, and I can make $500. I don't know.
No, I think that's pretty. I think that's a pretty accurate hypothesis, and I think that if you brought in 100 guys who pay money to fuck prostitutes, there's going to be 85 of them that would probably rather have someone that they were having
that they're
sex
in love with.
Yeah, you know? It's a sad relationship there, man. But and maybe that's a good. Maybe that's see. I think that there's an undocumented psychic plague that is afflicting humanity right now, and it's internet porn. I think it's all these fucking dudes, just not me at all, but all these other guys just constantly jerking off to porn. And I think this is a precursor to the next thing that's going to happen, which is sex androids and the effect that that's going to have on human mating. It's like, think of like how that would fuck up, you know, I don't know, a tribe of chimpanzees, if suddenly you release these like robotic, horny, constantly in heat female chimpanzees into chimps that normally have to like compete for their mate, it would like mess up everything. I don't know.
Right. But we're not worried about underpopulating the human species, right? We're not.
It's just more, what's it going to do for, like, I'm just thinking day to day. It's like, so you're a bachelor.
Well, it's going to force us to disassociate love from sex, for sure.
Right.
Because the technology is invading sex, and it's deconstructing sex.
Right.
Like the idea that a man could open a laptop and type in redhead cheerleader roller skates pickle
and
get exactly what they're looking for.
Yeah.
If you told that to my grandpa, he'd be like, well, then no one's ever going to fuck another woman ever again. Yes. Right. And the answer to him would be like, well, I guess you'd meet someone special and you'd talk to them about the pickle and you'd and so we have to put ourselves in the grandpa shoes and go, okay, so 50 years from now, yeah, you're going to, if not actual robots, it'll probably be better than robots. It'll be like this sort of
neurological interface.
Yeah, you'll put a wand on your head and it'll induce a dream state where you can do whatever you want to whoever you want and never have to tell anybody about it.
Yeah.
That's going to force us to say, okay, sex is not love and vice versa. Sex can be involved with love. But love has something to do with partnership and compatibility.
Yeah.
And having children, which involves sex. But then there's this idea of good sex, and I'm in love, and we have great sex, and it's like, I don't know, like yeah. So I don't know. I don't think they're absolutely completely entwined with each other, but they're going to get unraveled by technology for sure.
It's starting to get unraveled. It will get unraveled. But then you run into this other fascinating facet of it, which is that, so you break up with your girlfriend, but in the same way that, like, you know, your girlfriend uses your computer and, like, you know, her info is still in there. In that same way, you guys did the classic like brain scan of each other. So that when you're on vacation, you can kind of be with each other's avatar or whatever, if you want to. So you guys break up, but then you just, either through the neurological interface or through some kind of USB card that you put in the back of your sex android, you just put you just could scroll through your exes, inducing those personalities and whatever the thing is, so that the breakup is just, you know, that's a different person.
I do think, and I think you and I luckily will be, if we're not dead, we'll at least be off the market by the time this happens. But I do, Occam's razor says to me, we'll enter a world where sex, stimulating sex is basically masturbation, and that's it. And we genetically, procreation is completely separated from it, as is like life partnership. I don't think there will be, in this world, it's like this Logan's Run world where it's like everyone, as you say, it's like whether it's experiencing other people's fantasies or fake ones or ones that they create, or it'll all be masturbation. It'll all be personal because we're figuring out very quickly how to stimulate each other and ourselves artificially. Like, it doesn't take that much. Speaking as a guy, like Jessica Rabbit can give you a boner.
Sure.
Like a guy can take three colors with a crayon and give you a hard on.
Yeah,
drawing a woman with there's like, you know, silicone dolls that, like, you know, when you walk past a mannequin sometimes you go like, hubba hubba, like we will figure out how to make soulmate partnership obsolete sexually. And I could picture us being like a species of people walking around saying mellow greetings to each other and going into our little hovels and like just being addicted to like all this sexual stimulation.
Yeah.
And like the weird thing is that also like all the stigmas about lifestyles like gayness and stuff like that won't matter anymore, because you'll be able to, you know, go into your house and put on a hat that makes you into a woman or a dog.
Sure.
None of that, there won't be any social stigmas about sex anymore. The sexual revolution will have come and gone 8 times over.
Right.
It won't be an issue anymore. Sexuality will just be like It'll be like picking your nose. It's like, we just prefer not to do it in front of each other, but it's like,
whoa, that's a crazy universe, man.
There's no taboo.
Holy shit.
But then we'll, and almost, wouldn't it go back to like being a kind of Elizabethan thing with, in terms of marriage and procreation?
Yeah.
Because people would be politically inclined to procreate, but I don't think women would carry the babies to term. You know, it's like we see this culture developing with designer birth and like,
yeah.
Like, you know, women becoming more and more, male-like in their, you know, their desires and energies,
yeah.
Like in the workplace and things, like you see more and more, like, so some women are absolutely disgusted by it, and it's so unfeminine to talk about, like, oh yeah, I'm just gonna have this baby put in me, and they're gonna rip it out, and it's like, or I'm gonna have it put in someone else, and
yeah.
Blah, blah. But aren't we? I think we're gonna. We might head there, right? We're going to look back on the days when we carried these things around in our bodies and then squeezed them out of our vaginas.
Primitive. It'll seem so ridiculous. All the poor, devastated, and destroyed vaginas from the births. And it's sad. It'll be like looking back when there was smallpox or something. The days when the
Yeah, and we're very capable of taking weird shit in stride. Like, you look at circumcision, it's like, it's the controversy still rages on.
Sure.
Like, but it's like, we handle anything culturally, like, so if our children's children are born into a world where doctors are telling them, oh, childbirth is like, it's like an appendix, it's like a thing,
yeah.
It's like a vestigial thing that we used to do,
and it's bad for the baby, they're probably going to say, you know, if you, yeah. Why would you do that? Why, it's like, why would you put a child at risk by,
yeah.
by creating the child in your womb?
Yeah.
We have computers that handle that now.
Yeah, this Yamaha incubator, like it is like studies show that these kids, they score higher on math tests when they become 15. It's better for everybody. You come in a cup, or you come into the tube on your wall.
It's in a tube.
This is like you go into your apartment and you call up your fantasy, and there's like a little suction thing on your penis.
Yeah.
So then you come and your sperm goes through a pneumatic tube into a central processing center,
yeah.
and the computer analyzes your genetics and pairs you with somebody that'll lower your risk of the child being a Down syndrome or whatever else
or
we want.
Dahmer or whatever.
Yeah. It'll be like the Federal Reserve controlling interest rates. It's like there'll be like initiatives ethnically too. We need more biracial, triracial, or we need less. We need to, the Caucasoid gene is in danger of dying out. We want to protect it like the spotted leopard.
No, man, it's not going to be like that. It's not even going to be so beautiful, like keeping certain genes. It's going to be like, you know, Apple knows genetically what type of employee works best there,
yeah.
And they're going to like give you bonuses or discounts on their machines if you like allow them to
put an Apple gene in there.
Yeah.
Like the kids that are better at operating iPads,
yeah.
Are
yeah, kids that Jobs will be proud of. That, and also the other thing you're going to be able to do instead, this whole thing of like blasting your jizz into a Yamaha incubator, and like I picture it as like a lava lamp sitting in your house, like your friends come over and there's a little baby growing and it's like lava lamp thing. But I think it'll be like you jizz in this tube, this pneumatic tube underneath your computer desk. It's the jizz gets sucked into the processor, and it doesn't make a real baby. It's just like a fun game where it analyzes your DNA, and like you make virtual babies,
right.
Based on like, oh, let's see what it would be like if I mix my jizz with Michelle Obama.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could just have fun, like, you know, it's like some like The Sims for jizz, you know. It's like, that's what it's going to be like. You could populate your Minecraft world with your actual simulated genetic kids. The future.
I mean, you can't, yeah, it's like if there is the singularity that now is like this thing that's in the air. Like for some reason, I was just talking about the singularity, courtesy of the audience at my podcast.
I know, I saw you last night.
Right.
That's why, yeah.
Maybe that's why it's in the air or whatever. But it's interesting. Like this, we all have this feeling that we're going to keep making computers smarter and smarter, and that the computers are going to get so smart that they don't need us anymore. But this goes back to something I wanted to say earlier when you were talking about like we're going to evolve inward. Why would we go out into space? There's one exception to that I can think of, which is that, you know, we are primates. We have a very primate like centric kind of point of view. Like we're monkeys, and that is only one of a billion ways to succeed biologically. We kind of lucked out. We tend to think of ourselves as being the end of a very linear kind of arms race biologically, where it's like, oh, it all led to us. It's not really so much like that. It's like we're the Big Bang Theory of evolution. Like, in other words, we're a one of many pilots that was produced,
right,
that ran for many seasons, and it just kind of bore out, and like, it's, yeah, a random result. Honeybees and ants, like think about how fucking advanced ants are, and the idea that you have to become sentient and emotional and in order to create handguns and spaceships,
yeah,
is, I think that's a false kind of assumption we tend to make emotionally, or rather, it's just like we're fish in a fish tank. We can't think any differently. And I it could be, you know, one of these planets so many billions of light years away that we'll never find it or see it. The monkeys didn't luck out so much. They didn't make it. They weren't the primates didn't extend that long, or they were out eaten and out hunted,
yeah,
by like these like really super efficient killer ants or something.
Yes.
And those things never had to get individually smart, but as colonies of insects, they became so advanced that they become like a space-born like evolved kind of insectoid race.
The Zerg. You don't play StarCraft 2, do you?
No.
Okay, I'll show you. Forget it.
Isn't that just multiplayer?
That's what do you call that? That's a God damn it, RTS game. You know, where, uh-huh, you're like building armies and fighting.
Yeah, I get intimidated by that stuff.
It's by the way, please keep going. I did not mean to derail
I was just saying
video game reference.
Like that would be an example of a space faring species that might not give a fuck what kind of iPads,
sure,
you know, stimulated their penises. Like,
right,
like they might not evolve inward. They might actually just feel like we're ants. We gotta get out there.
Yes.
We gotta get more food. We gotta get more space, more territory. They might just not even have that frontal lobe or something that makes them care about making fake women.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, man. There is that, I think there is that species-centric narcissism where you think that just because you're, you know, we are driving around in cars or we have this technology that somehow that makes us better, when we don't even know what field, the subjective universe that these beings are living in. We don't know what ants are living in, or like mice. Did you ever read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yeah.
Man, one of my favorite parts in that was when, a spoiler alert from a long time ago, hilarious book, if you guys haven't read that, you should, but that awesome thing about laboratory mice, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Laboratory mice are the very tips of the tentacles of super intelligent beings that,
right,
are extruding into this universe to do studies,
yeah,
on scientists. It's like, that's a joke, but the reality is we have no idea what the experience of bees are, what the experience of ants are, what the experience of any of these other beings or the microbes that make up our bodies, you know,
yeah,
maybe they are super advanced.
Yeah. Our favorite animals, the ones that are closest to us that we know the most about, dogs, like they experience the world so completely differently. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface of how they really experience it. We just know that we see everything with our little camera eyes, that we can barely smell anything because,
yeah,
our eyes moving to the front of our heads. In order for our vision to get better and to be color and three dimensional, it impeded like the development of these snouts, you know, and the snout. So it's like God was like, fuck your nose, who cares? You're a monkey. Like, you need to be able to swing from branches and recognize ripe fruit. Dogs, not so much. Cats, not so much. And they like smell shit. Like they it's hard for us to conceive of organisms that use a different sense than we use,
yeah,
primarily. Like, but for them, like, you know, they're not blind or anything, but their eyes are like no big deal. Like they're just smelling everything. And even more so for like insects and undersea creatures and stuff. It's like there's a lot of ways to perceive the world and think about it. And if those creatures happen to become the top dog on their planet, their iPads would not look like iPads. They would not. It just wouldn't even. That doesn't even. that sentence doesn't even make it's stupid to say, but it's like
the technology would be incomprehensible to us. We wouldn't understand what it was. It might look like little globs of crystalline pollen or something, which is what they use. Who knows what it could be?
Yeah, ants like vomit into each other's mouths, and there's chemicals in their vomit that tell the other ant everywhere they've been and everywhere they're planning to go. It's trophallaxis. It's a really advanced form of communication. They're tasting each other's intentions and things. So if those guys get the edge on us, and it, you know, they're one nuclear war away from doing it, because they're not going to go anywhere. You know, they make spaceships or what? I don't know, spaceships. It's a monkey thing. Like whatever.
Yeah, we think about spaceships because it's like we are still stuck with the idea that we have to bring our meat bodies from point A to point B to be at point B. That's right. Where we're at right now.
Oh shit. I wonder if you know anything about this, because I can't wrap my fucking brain around it. I was reading this thing in this book about quantum physics at one point. It was, there's some particle or something. I'm hoping to say enough to remind you of something you understand that you can explain to me. There's some particle. I'm already getting it wrong by saying particle. I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. There's some, like, the top spin of an electron or a particle of some kind they come in pairs, and the orientation of one of them is, they usually travel together just naturally, but we know how to separate them, and when you separate them,
quantum entanglement, right?
I don't know, like they mirror each other instantly, and not speed of light instantly just mirror each other. So one is always like the other, even though they have no quote unquote communication between each other. They always are the same. So the idea is that you could base a technology on that where that would conquer the speed of light obstacle, where I could be on the other side of the universe. If you could use this technology to make a TV and a camera, you know, we could be communicating instantly. It wouldn't be like when the Apollo astronauts are in space and it takes 20 minutes.
You're still dealing with the problem of having to get that initial particle out there,
right?
You know,
but you only have to do it once.
Have to do it once. That's right. Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. I think that that's something I read. Einstein called it like spooky math, or he had some like superstitious sounding name for it, because it seems so magical that you could have these two things together at one point and they maintain this eternal connection regardless of the distance between them.
He called it black people math. He was really racist.
Yeah, it's so sad.
Yeah,
he did.
A lot of people. It's honorable of us not to publicize it that much. It's like it would just tarnish the contributions of a great scientist. Einstein was so racist.
He was one of the most racist scientists that ever lived. He was such a dick. He really was like very inappropriate,
and it wasn't like deep-seated, like culturally justified, like his dad hated Latvians or anything like that. It was like he really was just a crotchety old racist.
His quote from him is, "I just don't like him."
Yeah, he's just like, I'm basing this not on any cultural thing. It's like he's just like, I go to a drive-thru, I can't understand him.
That's it.
That's
he's like, and I don't want to go deeper with it. Like if you tried to take him into like the deeper subconscious level of why I didn't like it, and he's called many people. He just said, you're a pussy. Why do you even want to go there?
He was a toxic guy.
He was a toxic fuck. He was a fuck. Prophylactis. What do you call it?
The god of contraception. The Roman eight armed. Condom god?
No. What do you say when you puke in someone else's
mouth?
Trophallaxis. Trophallaxis. Yeah, that's a great. I love that you know that, man. But this quantum entanglement thing, what's really weird about it is, you know, like in Rosemary's Baby, remember where. Did you ever see Rosemary's Baby?
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite movies for some reason. But, you know, like the guy. Basically, there's the idea in witchcraft that if you get a piece of someone's clothes, if you get their hair, you can like fuck them up. And so very superstitious people will try not to leave their comb around and stuff because they don't want people to get their DNA. So if you take this idea of quantum entanglement, which is that one particle forever remains entangled with another particle, all of a sudden this weird shit about how witches always want to snatch a clump of your hair kind of makes sense, because it's like, oh, fuck, is there some invisible tube that they have now between your genetics and their whatever their ill intent is, that they can start blasting weird nastiness down the line? It's really interesting how quantum physics and superstition begin to like meet at the same place.
It's really profound how Eastern quantum physics gets as we learn more and more about the way the universe works. We find more and more that it's the Indians and the Chinese and the ancient times that were closer to the mark in terms of how the universe works. Like the things that they were saying before they invented paper and fireworks, way before we even were throwing rocks at each other in the West. That's the way you really have to cope with the universe. And it's interesting that scientists are uncovering that you know, the idea that light is a particle and a wave, and it doesn't matter which it is. And the idea that once you try to measure something, you can't measure it anymore, and all this kind of stuff. Like as quantum physics advances more and more, it becomes more and more zen-like.
Yeah. It is incredible that the two are finally meeting each other. And then when you throw into the equation, the thing's probably just a simulator anyway, that all we're uncovering is like the basic constraints of whatever the particular program that we're within is running. The things that we consider to be the laws of physics are just certain paradigms that some original programmer threw in to create whatever we're in right now. It gets really fucking weird and exciting, but really weird. I mean, I don't mean to keep going, this has got friends who listen to this, I'm sorry, but get used to it, because I'm never going to stop talking about how we're in a simulator. I can't, like, it's like the birth of a new, if this guy really does, like, if he can really prove this in a way that, and doesn't end up, quote, hanging himself, then, because the programmers don't want the machine to wake up.
Right.
Because that's the idea. Like, we're always talking about the singularity. Oh, no, the computers are going to wake up. And when the computers are going to wake up, man becomes irrelevant, because they're going to be able to use the ability to process information to improve themselves. Humans can only improve things based on the speed with which humans can work.
Right.
Once machines start improving themselves, we're able, humans, that is one, you know, the difference between a hard singularity and a soft singularity. Have you ever heard that before?
No.
So a hard singularity is like where the first computer wakes up and is like, whoa, fuck this. And then like immediately starts improving itself and improving other computers, waking up other computers. The other computers wake up and they form these super processors, this web. We get, what's the name of the thing in the Terminator? Fucking
Skynet.
So we get Skynet. Skynet goes online. That's a hard singularity. So it's like, bang, all of a sudden every computer wakes up. They, you know, swarms of nanobots reconstruct reality to create whatever they want, and we're just some little ingredient in that mass that they're molding to do whatever woken up computers want to do. Soft singularity is more of a kind of gradual progression towards this thing, and like what you're talking about with the neurological interface and this kind of fusing between man and the and machine. We kind of merge together into one thing. But
I think I'll go for that one. I'll put money on that one. The thing about humanity is, we're, at least by our measurement, we don't know, we can only know what we can perceive. We feel like we are the world's first sentient animal.
Right.
And by sentience, we mean consciousness. By consciousness, what we really mean, according to Campbell, Joseph Campbell anyway, is that we're the first animal to wake up and realize that we're going to die. A coyote eats a fox, and it's neither angry at the fox nor in love with it. It doesn't give a shit. It's like, it's doing what it needs to do to stay alive. It's running on instinct. As the Taoists say, it bears yin on its back and yang in its bosom, which is an expression I love. Like, it's like animals are perfect. As the book of Genesis implies, and all creation myths sort of harp on that theme, is that once upon a time we were perfect. We were animals. We were dead. And the origin mythologies, whether they're from African mythology or Western mythology, they tend to surround that theme of, like, once upon a time, this animal named man got this curse slash gift from the powers that be that made him wake up and realize he was going to die, and he freaked out, and he got cut off from the powers that be because he became his own thing.
Right.
And he became Woody Allen. You know, he became neurotic. And yeah. And everything became painful and hard, but also joyful and passionate. And it's our lot in life. So that's what we mean by sentience and consciousness. And we live in this big fear that we're going to that computers are going to wake up, that they're going to have that consciousness happen. Now the thing is, though, consciousness is the secondary result of it's super intelligence plus the default fact that we're all going to die, right? It's like will to live. Like the fox and the coyote share that with us. None of us want to die. We do whatever we can to stay alive. Yeah. The difference between the fox and the coyote and us is that we know it. We go, I don't want to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die no matter what I do. The fox and the coyote aren't thinking about
it. Okay, yeah. So it seems like there's a temporal quality to human consciousness, which is that we are able to think about the past and also think into the future, whereas animals seem to be more just totally completely in the moment. There's no
and we're made out of meat, and we don't know our programmer. We haven't met him,
right?
We never will. Or you know, our sentience, our anxiety about death, which results in our will to live, our ego, our quest to create, and our castration anxiety regarding the things we create, which is that our sons are going to become our fathers. These Mordreds are going to rise up against us and cut off our dicks and take over.
That's fucking crazy.
We fear that because we feel that way about ourselves.
Our creations. You mean like any creation? You don't mean just like your children? You mean like,
oh yeah, well, we feel that way about our children, but we as a species, we feel that way about computers. We're expressing that. We know mythologically, instinctively, mythology is just an expression of our instincts. We know instinctively that the young eat the old. We feel, therefore, like these cool young things we're creating, these iPads and these watches.
Yes.
The watches. What am I? My grandpa.
I was like, yes, the watches.
Douglas Adams was like, oh, yeah, always harping on digital watches, remember?
These digital watches will destroy us.
That they're going to eat us because why? Well, because they're going to want what we want. But are they going to want what we want?
Here's where it gets weird.
Are they just going to like get into bringing us drinks?
This is where it gets odd. So yeah, who knows? But that if we are a simulation and we are in a machine, then actually it's not that we have to worry about our computers waking up. It's that we're the machine itself beginning to wake up. We're thinking about our machines gaining this ghost popping into our computers and like suddenly waking up. But we are the simulation starting to come to an awareness of the fact that it's a simulation. And when you go back to the awesome creation stories, the one I'm most familiar with, you seem to be familiar with many of them. The one I'm most familiar with, of course, is the book of Genesis and the idea of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil and the fruit, the tree of life.
Right.
And so they eat from the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, and before they can get to the other tree, the tree of life,
right,
the weird thing that they say, that
is,
God says,
they're going to become like us.
Yes. And this is what we're worried about computers doing.
Right.
We're in the exact position that the mythological God was in back in the Garden of Eden, because now we're looking at our computers and we're like, fuck, the moment these things become aware of themselves, which is the knowledge of good and evil, the next thing these sons of bitches are going to want to do is make it so that we can't unplug their ass.
Right.
And the moment that fucking happens, that's when we're fucked. So it seems like whatever started back then is beginning to echo into our own technology.
My favorite thing that Joseph Campbell implied is that I was talking about this last night. I don't know how much of my show you saw and didn't see, but I was
By the way, there's a great show. You have a podcast, Harmontown, and it's a live show at Meltdown Comics. I'll have a link on my website.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You came to the show last night. We were recording it. It'll be up by the time this is up, probably. But this episode, it'll be episode 4. But I was talking in it about this thing that Campbell said about, he implied that mythology is a blueprint on our nervous system We create the gods that we worship because we have an instinctive feeling that that's what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be immortal. We're supposed to be able to raise the dead. We're supposed to be able to create planets, universes. We're supposed to be able to conquer all of these things, and we won't give ourselves a fucking break until the day we are like that. And in the Old Testament, Yahweh says to Job, which Campbell points to as a perfect example of the atonement with the Father. It's on the surface, it just looks like God's yelling at Job because Job questioned him after God gives Job all of these trials and things, in spite of him being a stand-up guy and always having God's back, and he kills his family and gives him smallpox and collapses the roof on him or whatever.
Fucks him.
And at the end of the story, in the third act of the story, Job says, he cracks for a second because he feels like it's all over. God's like, good job. And Job just can't fucking handle. He just can't help but, after all of that loyalty and humility, he just, like, as a parting shot, goes like, "Jeez, man, why? Can I just ask why?
Yeah,
can I just ask why? I tolerated all of it. I never doubted you. Can you just as a goodbye tell me why?" And God lays into him.
And
says, like, "Do you have a hand like me? Do you have an eye like me that can see everything? Do you have an arm like me that smites wickedness where it stands? Can you see across the fucking universe? Is your brain the size of the goddamn moon?" And it sounds like a dad talking to a son. This is my roof, you know. It's like, when you pay the rent, you know, the thing. And the interesting thing about that is that, as Campbell points out, he goes, it's very easy to look at that as simply an angry, jealous God yelling at you. And that's true. That's what's happening in that story. But it's also semantically and figuratively an invitation. He's saying, as your dad is saying to you, when he says, get a haircut, start paying rent, then you can take the car
out. Right.
God is saying to Job, are you God yet? You're not yet. You're a little monkey right now. I'm what you're gonna become one day.
Yeah.
You know, and mythically through figures like Christ and things, it's just like they're half God, half man.
Yes.
Like, the modern world is coming. You're going to have lasers. You're going to have microscopes. You're going to have singularities. And you're gonna make things that are smarter than you and crack off all the time. And when that happens, maybe you'll know how
I feel right now, asshole. Yeah, it's almost like having, like, the Sim. It's like having the Sims, and one of the Sims that you've been fucking around with, and just for fun. Did you ever play the game The Sims?
Well, I'm familiar enough with it.
I mean, you just inevitably become the most horrific sadist just out of boredom to the creatures. You'll block them into their house so they can't leave and watch them starve, and you'll just and you'll speed up time to, like, increase the acceleration of their demise, and you do it just for fun. But if those fucking things could talk, and they're like, what? Why?
So in that mythology, in the story of Job, for instance, if God, well, I don't know what we're saying God represents, but is, like, he's talking to the devil in that story, right?
Yes.
Is it Satan and God having a conversation?
Yes.
And Satan's saying, you know, these people love you so much, but they wouldn't love you as much if they had a run of bad luck. And God says, watch this, motherfucker. And these people love me. Like, is that what would those be expressions of in this model where we now realize that the Matrix is
two coders? It's just two programmers. It's two programmers, and one programmer is challenging the other programmers.
He's saying, if you abuse these people enough, they're gonna wake up.
Yeah,
and God is saying they'll never wake up.
They'll never wake up. We'll be able to do it. Everyone's like, no, man, you haven't put in the right restrictions in these fucking things. They're not going to stay bowing down to you forever, and when that happens, we're all kind of fucked. It's basically two competing programmers. It's one of the programmers, it seems to be more on the side of the simulation, and one of the programmers seems to be, like, really distant from the simulation and kind of staying back. And, you know,
it's like Satan then is that represents the half of a person playing a video game that's saying it is just a game, and therefore the object is to have fun and win.
Yeah.
And God is saying, no, he's the pretentious artiste at the gaming company that says, this is not just a game. Minecraft is very important.
Well, yeah, it's or it's more like someone running this simulation to try to come to some conclusion that maybe the things, maybe the programmer's not aware of, and then another programmer meddling with the simulation who's got more idea of what's happening. It's almost like someone it's like Satan's the cheat code. You know what I mean? Satan's coming in there with cheat codes and making it so the rules of the simulation get...
Well, because if it is just a game, as you say, you seal off the house and watch the person die. Like, the point of a game is to experience it,
yeah,
which is hedonism.
Yes.
It's to fuck and to suck, yes, and to eat and to see what happens if this happens. Serial killers, yeah, are playing a video game. They're cutting cats open, yes, when they're kids, and then they grow into these sociopaths that are, you know, just... They want to make androids by drilling holes in their victims' heads.
Right.
They don't have this thing that we call a consciousness. A guilt. You know,
no guilt.
So they become monsters, and they're cheating. We're fascinated with mafia or mythology because it's very similar to serial killer fascination, because we're fascinated by cheaters. We're fascinated by people who,
yes,
who aren't bound by an inexplicable but fundamentally binding fealty to the concept that the game is more than a game, that there's something that's going to come afterward,
yeah,
that the game's forever, and the devil is saying on the other shoulder, this is it, baby. That's all there is to it. So,
yeah,
you might as well, that might as well not be a window. That might as well be an elephant. You might as well experiment. You might as well do this stuff. And but then it's like, then it all falls apart according to the other programmer. It's I'm trying to get my head around.
Well, it's working out something, man. The problem is we don't have all the information. We don't know if you play the thought experiment. Okay, well, let's imagine this thing is a simulation and we're inside a simulation. You can kind of answer some questions. Number one, we don't know who the creator is. That's one thing we don't know. If you want to like get mythological, you could say, you know, like, well, in the Old Testament, it is God made man in his image. So the implication is that the creator created a simulation to simulate life on planet Earth prior to the singularity for some reason. And that's what we're in right now. And so the simulation's running. We don't know exactly who did it. We can imagine maybe it's someone like us. That's all we know. But we don't even know that. We don't know the purpose of it. We don't know what is it doing? Is it trying to predict something? Is it a generator? Is it a power generator? Maybe it's just generating novelty. Maybe it's some kind of machine that just generates new ideas. Because you were saying, you know, machine's never going to write Citizen Kane. But in this theory, in this weird paradigm or thought experiment, a machine did write Citizen fucking Kane,
right,
because it was a machine.
Right.
And maybe that's what it does. Maybe it just harvests ideas. Maybe it's this ultimate super processor that spits out shows and entertainment and all kinds of amazing things, like a duck laying eggs or a goose or I don't know. We don't know what it is. But this is the thing I keep hitting upon, which is like, yeah, okay. So just for fun, imagine this is true. This is all a simulation. Why then do anything based on morality or ethics? Why then, what are the reasons for following rules?
Well, following that metaphor, my answer to somebody, if you played Minecraft, you mentioned it before.
I've played it a little bit. Maybe you can help me understand it more.
I have a friend named Justin Roiland, brilliant kid, genius. I don't know, I say kid now, he's probably 40 and I'm getting so old. He's like a kid, he's got a wart on his nose, he's got grandchildren. We can get back to talking more specifically about Minecraft and why it's cool later, but just it's a sandbox game where you run around and you make shelter and you try to avoid getting killed.
On my forum, they have a server. They've got a Minecraft server on my forum, and I go on there sometimes, and I can't figure it out totally.
If you're running your own server, you can very easily just give yourself a bunch of gold or diamond, which you need desperately to do all kinds of cool shit. You can give yourself anything. You can have infinite power. Just give yourself all these things that normally, if you're playing the game, you have to mine for.
Right.
So I don't want to get too sidetracked by the metaphor itself. But what I was going to say in answer to your question is ethics, morality, religion
Are they an expression of the idea that games are more fun when you take them seriously?
Yes.
Because cheating. My mom used to say to me when she would hear me get frustrated at my video games on my Commodore 64, she'd hear me go, "God damn it, fuck, I hate shit, yeah. fuck." And then I knew it was coming, two, three, four, and I'd hear from the other room, "If that game is frustrating you so much, why do you play it?" And her unspoken part of that was like, you know how you can win? You know how these aliens can stop beating you? Turn it off.
Yes.
Go out and play football.
Yeah.
They'll never win. But where's the fun in that? And so the universe, as you said, just implied, is it's this narcissistic, just almost unintelligent kind of throbbing thing that is simply, once upon a time there was nothing, and the nothing decided that it hated itself, but it and it wanted to be something.
Yeah.
And so it just keeps throbbing, and this is the Big Bang, and it blows up into a universe, and then it, according to some, is going to then, you know, suck back into a they call that a singularity too, don't they? And then it's going to Big Bang again, and then it's going to Big Suck again. And
well, that's
gonna...
the right. That is one. That's definitely like one. That's one idea. The idea is things start as a singularity, a field of pure everythingness. The idea being everything was in sort of absorbed in one thing, the size of the head of a pin,
right.
And it blows up, and all the particulates. You know, some of them form planets, suns. Some of them form humans. That was one idea, but now another idea that's coming out is that actually the fucking Big Bang is a white hole. What you're seeing is a white hole, or the exit of a black hole. So the Big Bang is actually a kind of like explosion in, or an inflation of some aspect of the multiverse, where the runoff from some
other dimension. So it's like the what we were calling the Big Bang / Big Suck. This could be a solid state universe that's just sort of like flowing through its own navel.
Yes.
Like it's just moving, it's just circulating.
It just keeps, it's almost like it's burrowing into nothingness with, it keeps, every time a star supernovas and turns into a black hole, that is actually burning through whatever this,
and it's pumping more universe into some other,
yeah,
void.
That's it. That's... like drains in a pool or something, yeah. And we're just part of that runoff, is the idea. But man, I love that idea, which is like, yeah, you are definitely going to enjoy a game more, you're going to enjoy a movie more, you're going to enjoy entertainment more if you believe it's real, if you're sucked into it.
It's weird that the odd contradiction of that though is that when you, that I can't get my brain around, is that when you play Grand Theft Auto and you do evil things, it's because you are taking the game seriously. You're hitting a prostitute in the head with a baseball bat because you're immersing yourself a little too much in the reality. And so it's the better way to play. When I play those video games, I tend to be a little more noble than I'm being asked to be. I try to. I get pangs of guilt about, like,
isn't
hitting
that weird?
People.
The guilt pangs. I want to talk about that for a second. Have you ever played Fallout?
Yeah. Oh,
God. What a fucking great game, man. Yeah. But from time to time, I would get frustrated with the game, and I would, you know, just go on a bloodthirsty rampage through one of the towns. And if you guys have never played this game, you got to play it. The fucking kids, you're not allowed to kill kids. But what's even worse is the kids will, like, if you kill their parents or you start killing relations, they'll start screaming and crying and running with their whole, they'll duck down and put their hands over their heads to, like, try to prevent you from killing them, even though you can't. But you feel guilt. I've felt guilt in this sandbox game with no real impact.
I mean, there's a real world explanation for those feelings, and it's not, we mistake morality and ethics and compassion for these artificial codes that we've created as social contracts to keep our societies running smoothly. But a lot of it stems from, I saw a documentary comparing chimps and gorillas to humans, and particularly chimps, our closest cousins, and the uplifting truth of it is that basically everything that makes us dicks is like their business. Like, the chimps are, you know, they're pretty treacherous creatures, and they do these funny things, like where If a human puts a grape under one of two cups and points at one of the cups, the chimp always goes for the other cup. Always. Can't fucking control itself. Never gets it through its chimp head that a human's not trying to con it out of a grape. Can't fucking deal with the idea. Just, you can make a chimp take whichever cup you want by pointing at the opposite one. It's that cartoonish.
Wow.
And they compare chimp babies of the same age as human babies and watch their behavior develop. And the thing that makes humans different, and this has nothing to do with us being awesome or spiritual or anything, it's just we're a very specific form of primate. We're a different experiment that really paid off. And part of what happened to us is we became very clingy to each other. We started to love each other a lot more. Our sense of community and compassion took a front seat. And human babies, before they have any, you know, human children have to be told shit is right and wrong. Like they'll do fucked up shit. And that's part of humans being an incredibly adaptable species. If you put them on the North Pole, they'll invent 60 words for snow, and they'll fit in wherever they need to fit in, and part of our and culture will. But in spite of that moral flexibility, there's an inherent compassion for a fellow human. That children have an instinctive desire to, if an adult human drops a clothespin on the floor in front of it while it's performing a task, the child is, like, goes and grabs it and holds it up, wants to give it to the grown up. You know, you see kids are doing that all the time. You think they're playing a game like a golden retriever, but there's more to it than that. They're trying to help, and we sacrifice ourselves for each other, and that guilt that we feel. When we let somebody down, or when they're afraid of us, when they think they're going to kill us, is a sort of excommunication phobia where we're not being good monkeys. We're not doing this right. This person's afraid of me. I hurt somebody.
Yeah.
I'm not long for this world if I got to function on my own.
Right.
I will not survive out there. We're a primate that, in order to survive against dogs and cats, we started to become more like dogs. The other primates are all dying out. Like they hang out and they eat nuts and berries and they fuck and they're kind of loosely communal, and they make noises when people come near them. But they're all going extinct because they can't get beyond this kind of lush tropical environment. And they kind of human beings got out of the forest and started walking on our hind legs, and we also developed this pack mentality.
Yes,
we became very dependent on each other, and when you take a sociopath, a serial killer, you could take the hardest motherfucker in the world, you put him in solitary confinement, and we call it torture now. We're thinking of eliminating solitary confinement because there's no such thing. You can't warp a human brain severely enough to make us want to be alone. We are terrified of excommunication, terrified of being cast adrift.
Yeah, man. You know what that makes me think of? That makes me think of this idea that I've had. It kind of reminds me of what you were talking about, the progression of the levels of consciousness of the universe. It starts with this singularity, pre-white hole, whatever you want to call the fucking thing. But it's like, if the universe wakes up, if there's an idea, if you believe, and I do believe this, that consciousness is not dependent on neurology, that it's something that's sort of more like a waveform, that like a frequency that exists in the universe, and kind of that we're like meat antennas that the consciousness like that tune into the fucking thing. But so you have this original consciousness, right? And the thing wakes up for whatever reason, accident, who knows why? We don't know why. It's the big question, but the thing wakes up. Skynet goes online and it's just one thing. It's just one fucking thing. It's everything that is now is one thing in the ultimate form of solitary confinement, because it's everything. It's completely by itself. It's one formless blast of consciousness, infinitely alone. And that is torture, and that's going to create a fucking nervous breakdown, a universal nervous breakdown, where the thing shatters into zillions of pieces, and then we have the Big Bang, and then now we've got us.
Got it.
You and me, and inside us is that original sense.
And that's the soft singularity, right? We merge with the things we create. We become an all-encompassing thing that knows everything. And when you know everything, you know nothing. When you are everything, you are nothing. And then we don't like that, and then we explode again.
That's it. Yeah, it's always trying to... Well, I think what it is it's like, it's always trying to come to terms with that fucking ache. Because that thing in solitary confinement, what if solitary confinement isn't inducing a state? What if solitary confinement is creating enough stillness where the person is
unifying them with a sad fact that nothing matters.
That's it. With the original terror state, it's unifying them with that original awful thing that caused the thing to explode. And the hippy dippy thing that I like to think is maybe this yo-yo keeps getting thrown out in the form of all these different human particulates and planets, because the hope is that eventually when it does come congeal back together again, we've all worked this shit out and it's paradise now, and now we get to be right. This one infinite orgasm wave that exponentially increases forever, and that's heaven or paradise, right, or the second coming.
But the Eastern philosophies have it a little more accurately, I think, when they, because they don't characterize nirvana as a blissful place. They characterize it as a place of stillness, and it's neither good nor bad. And the Taoists talk about the darkness within the darkness, the gateway to all understanding. And they don't say, the Eastern religions don't say, this is a great thing. You want to achieve this perfect state. You're going to be so happy. Your car payments are going to be on time. That's us putting that shit on that. What they say is, hey, life got you down and up. You know the reason why? Because if you take a valley, you create a mountain. And so the fact that you had a good day on Monday is responsible for your bad Tuesday. Do you want to escape that? There's only one way: to be dead, to be perfect, to be a rock, to be nothing. And that's where that Eastern philosophy is like, we take the Western approach is like, you look at our version of Buddha. He got the shit kicked out of him because it wasn't enough for us. So it was like prove it when you say be nice to everybody, no matter how bad they are. We needed blood.
Yeah,
in the story, we need somebody to get their shit kicked apart, and so that there's like proof in the pudding, and it's like he had to be nailed to a cross, and death had to be conquered, and all that stuff. Buddha just sat under a tree, and it's like people offered him pudding, and he said no, but like Jesus got his shit beaten up, and proved that it really seriously, it doesn't matter, like no matter how hard they come at you. And I got sidetracked by that thought. I was on a more important thing. The more important thing is that I think you figured it out. I'm very comfortable with this idea that yes, it's there's consciousness is just consciousness. What we call consciousness is an energy. It is a wave. It is the thing that evolves.
Yeah.
It is the thing that starts as one thing, which is solitary confinement. It hates it. It has a schizophrenic break.
Yeah.
It splits into everything. Everything is different from everything. The beautiful, uplifting thing about that is that you can have a nice day for the rest of the day, because if you don't know something, that just means you're a little further away from going out of your mind.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's okay to forgive people their racism and their sexism and their grumpiness and their detachment from each other, because yes, it solves a lot of problems to hug somebody and to relax. But then again, there's a big hug coming that's going to be the end of all of us. And the more we police racism and anger and war, and the more we try to solve all these problems and become perfect, the more the happier we create eruptions of happiness, but we're also just speeding along this process. Maybe not speeding it along. We probably don't have any control over how fast it happens, but we're worshiping at the altar of a thing that ultimately represents our annihilation.
You mean the god Prophylaxis?
we're turning into ants when we become open-minded.
Yeah.
We're becoming a little more closed-minded. We say like, well, I don't know this and I don't know that and I don't know anything. But particularly that's how we express, like, as modern Silver Lakers, we go, that's our definition of whatever the opposite of racism is. Like, we kind of go, well, I don't really know anything in particular. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
What do you mean, you people? What do you mean Tony's different? What does that mean? I don't know what you're talking about, because I have no idea. That's how good I am.
Oh, yeah.
Goodness expressed as nothingness, as apathy, as unawareness. Whereas the caveman next to you is like, Mexicans are brown. Their hair's different.
Well, yeah, I think that there is something to be said for that level of, and I'm not even just racism, but fucking anything. This is like,
I want to make a case for racism if I accomplish one thing before I leave here.
I was hoping you would do that.
I seem to be harping on this theme.
No, well, man, what it is, what racism represents, or any kind of bigotry, or any kind of anything where someone's passionate, is it does represent this like real intense interface with the game of this whatever this thing is that we're in. You're talking about. There's this.
That's what I can't figure. I keep getting confused. It flip flops in my head. This idea of you're not supposed to cheat at the video game. Was cheating is who is it? Is it the devil or God on your shoulder that's telling you to cheat?
Well, no, the question is, like, maybe the whole point of the fucking thing, if you want to throw a point in, is to turn off the Xbox and go outside like your mom recommended. Maybe the idea is we keep going through this thing again and 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 again until finally we get to this wonderful point where the game just isn't like any computer game. Eventually you get bored of it. Uh-huh. So all of a sudden, the fucking things that seem so important to you become, you know, you're buying into it a little bit, but it's like, yeah, you know, when I was when I was a teenager, a blowjob was one of the most important things ever. Do you remember how important blowjobs were? I mean, it was like magic. It was like traveling in time or flying or some incredible potent moment. And I still love blowjobs. They're greatest things.
They get the job done.
They get the job done. But it's not.
But if it doesn't happen on Tuesday, you're you'll be alive on Wednesday.
It's not like the sun god descended into your life for a moment. So in that same way, it's like maybe, you know, over the course of this simulation running itself and running itself and running itself and running itself, all the individual pieces of the simulation just stop buying it as much. Or remember when your fucking, I don't know, like your uncle or your dad when you were a kid would tell you a ghost story and it would scare the shit out of you. It was really entertaining. And then the older you got, all of a sudden the ghost story stopped impacting you as much. Right, you weren't in the trance state as much. So maybe that's it. Maybe that's what's happening is the great uncle that is the universe, this whole human existence thing, we're not buying it as much anymore.
So like God in Groundhog Day is trying to teach Bill Murray to, you know, it's holding him still and making him repeat until he really self-actualizes.
Yeah.
And he's got to go through all these phases where he's cheating and he even goes through a phase where he thinks his goal is to do as much as possible, but it's still not enough. And the only thing that really delivers him is some secret hatch called love or whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
But the thing that's disturbing about that is it brings to mind this, I can't remember what mythology it is, what cosmology, it might be Aztec, it might be Mayan. They have these ages, these calendars, and they believe in these worlds that are getting progressively more devoid of energy, and we're not on the last one according to this whatever cosmology I'm thinking of, but they foretell an age that comes out. Like the multiple universes keep happening, but there was a time when people were giants,
sure,
and there's that they didn't. That's the how they look. You know, the bigger you are, the more powerful you are. So, like, they in their mythology is like there was a time 7 universes ago when everybody was like 90 feet tall, and we're only a couple of universes before the end of it all, and everyone's going to be like little dwarves and kind of stunted.
Sure.
And it's like
that makes sense.
Entropy, like it's like if it isn't just infinite, if you can't, and what we find with machinery is that you always have to lose a little bit of energy. There's no such thing as 100% efficiency. So if the universe is a throbbing engine or heartbeat, you know, is it losing a little fraction of itself every time? Is there going to be one less Kurt Cobain in the next explosion and then keep going, like no Babe Ruth in the one after that?
Oh, fuck. Yeah. just all the flavor. It's like soup that keeps getting watered down as it telescopes inward. Holy shit, man. This has been incredible. This is real. Like, please, you've got to come back on the podcast.
Oh man, I'm in love. I can't believe we took this long to find each other.
I know. I feel the same way. I was afraid to say it first.
I'm going to go home and listen to all your previous episodes and make sure you haven't had this good a time with anybody else.
No.
I'm going to handle this in a very unhealthy way.
No, this one went to warp drive so fast. It was very intense.
I'm going to be texting you like, sounds like Greg Behrens also pretty interesting.
What if this is exactly what I thought? Everyone says the exact same thing. No, man, this one went deep. So you have your own podcast. Where can people find the podcast?
It's called Harmontown. I guess you just, I don't know if you Google it or.
I'll have the link. I just ask everybody that. And it's at Meltdown Comics. You do that once.
Oh, yeah. If you live in LA, like, it's very fun to come to the show. I've actually been doing the show for a year, and we just started podcasting, like, highlighted recordings of it. So is it really what it is? It's just therapy. I get up there with a drink, and Jeff Davis is my comptroller of Harmontown, and he tries to keep me on track in vain. And I just babble for an hour and a half or so, and then it's
hilarious. It's not just babble, like, you really do hit, like, you, it's cool to add the live audience, because, man, you really hit some hilarious moments. It, like, gets super funny.
It can be pretty fun. The audience is pretty great, because they've and I say this with all due respect and gratitude, they've drank the Kool-Aid. I mean, they're coming to see Dan Harmon, and these are people who are hardcore fans of my work and stuff, and they're paying $10, and they're not going to have a bad time. So they're a very energized audience. It's very much like when stand-ups talk about college crowds and stuff. It's like these are enthusiastic, very forgiving, very energetic people.
It's a good crowd, but you're good people too, man. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
All right, cool.
And Hare Krishna.
All right.
Thanks for listening, friends. Go leave a nice review on iTunes if you like this. And while you're at it, download a copy of this awesome song called Elephant Song by Mark Wirtz from the album.